Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 154. It's Monday, March 7th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, last week we had a really good example of a very palpable picture of getting back to normal, and that was with the State of the Union address. Very few masks, people hugging, kissing each other. Hadn't seen that very much. It's a kind of shocking when you actually see what, quote, normal was pre-pandemic displayed. But just to, as an example of how that doesn't necessarily indicate that we're completely post-COVID, this from NPR. State of the Union attendance required a COVID test. Six legislators tested positive. At least six legislators announced that they had tested positive for the coronavirus ahead of last week's State of the Union address. To attend the speech, guests, even those who are fully vaccinated, were required to produce a negative test. And there was no mask requirement, and I saw very, very few masks there. I assume some probably really high-risk people either wore a mask or maybe chose not to attend. This isn't a huge like positivity rate for people that getting tested because there were probably 500, maybe more people there. So there was a lot of folks. So, you know, maybe 1% or a little more of the people testing positive. But COVID is still around. And of course, it is often in asymptomatic form. You don't necessarily see it. And one question people have been asking is just exactly how many people have been infected during the pandemic. Well, we get some picture of that. This from Medical Express. CDC estimates U.S. COVID infections now close to 140 million. The United States has had about 140 million COVID infections since the start of the pandemic, new data from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention show. The new findings are from the CDC's National Antibody Seroprevalence Survey, a blood test for antibodies to the coronavirus triggered by infection, not by vaccination. As of late January, so this is a little over a month old, about 43% of the U.S. population had been infected with the virus, the CDC said. That includes nearly 60% of children up to age 18, almost half of the people age 18 to 49, 37% of those age 50 to 64, and 23% of those age 65 and older, according to the CDC. Well, that's probably good news considering the ravaging of the Omicron. Definitely jumped that up, and it's probably a little higher now since this is like 5 or 6 weeks old. But that definitely leaves plenty of room of people who have not been infected. Of course, this doesn't separate people who are vaccinated and unvaccinated. I have a feeling that the number of unvaccinated people who are uninfected is actually a pretty small part of the population. Okay, well, testing is still a thing, and if you need additional tests, you can order more this week. This from CNN. Americans can order another round of free at-home COVID-19 tests this week. Americans can order additional free at-home COVID-19 tests supplied by the U.S. government starting this week. Every home in the U.S. can order an additional set of four tests. You just need to go to covidtests.gov. That's covidtests.gov. Okay, well, here's one additional thing the Biden administration has proposed in order to deal with the ongoing endemic COVID-19. This from CNBC. People who test positive for COVID can receive antiviral pills at pharmacies for free, Biden says. President Joe Biden said Americans will be able to get COVID antiviral pills for free if they test positive at a pharmacy. The administration will launch hundreds of sites nationwide this month at CVS, Walgreens, and Kroger, as well as community health centers, a White House official said. Now, this is a really good example of a great public pronouncement, but when you look at it from a more detailed public health perspective, this kind of falls apart. So this is actually the basic initiative is really good, that you're trying to link up people who test positive with getting antiviral pills early. That's been a problem. First of all, there was a shortage, but now that there's more and more available, the difficulty is getting people to actually test positive to actually get these antivirals within the first 5 days of any symptoms. But this is a very modest initiative. There are about 88,000 pharmacies in the United States. So it might sound great that they're launching hundreds of sites nationwide, but you may be talking about 1, maybe 2%, maybe when they get it launched even more, it's a few percent. But this is hardly like you can go to your local pharmacy, get tested for free, and get antiviral pills for free. It's going to be really hard for people, the public, to know where they need to go to get this, if they're even aware that this is available. This is a perfect example of our piecemeal fragmented healthcare. It reminds me of like comparing the U.S. healthcare system to the United Kingdom's healthcare system. Their National Health Service is a national health service. They can do initiatives for the entire country. They can just say, you can go to a pharmacy or a healthcare facility, get tested for free, and if you test positive, get free access to antiviral pills. And when people hear that, they know that they can go to these places. And that's, if it's not universal, it's nearly universal. Way less confusing. In this case, when you've got a 1 in 100 chance that your pharmacy is actually participating in this, that's a crapshoot. And boy, is it hard to put a real burden on consumers to try to figure out how to take advantage of these limited programs. Okay, well, as we're trying to get back to normal, we had a bunch of public health experts throw in their two cents this week. This from MedPage Today. Public health experts pitch their own path to the next normal. Less than a week after the White House released its updated COVID-19 preparedness plan, a group of more public health experts issued a white paper with their own ideas for moving a nation into what they call the next normal. While there's quite a bit of overlap between the two plans, the 136-page document by the COVID Roadmap Group outlines additional details and strategies for living with COVID-19 in the future. The group identified 12 key areas of focus, and I'm just going to hit a few of these. I'm not going to cover all these, but ones that I thought were particularly interesting. One that I think has been way underreported and way underpaid attention to, and is a huge public health infrastructure issue for the future, is air quality, and that means within buildings. According to the report, the pandemic revealed the poor air quality inside buildings. All public buildings should have their air quality monitored and publicly graded. Schools, commercial buildings, and large apartment complexes should have MERV 13 filtration, and every classroom and childcare facility in the United States should have either MERV 13 or HEPA filters. All right, let's see that happen. Next, testing and surveillance. Testing is not at the level needed to provide full and real-time picture of case counts in the U.S., the report stated. PCR and rapid tests should screen for all respiratory viruses, not just SARS-CoV-2. Rapid tests also need to be ubiquitous, accessible, and free or very cheap. Very cheap meaning under $3 per test. I wish. True in some places of the world, not in America. The report also calls for an investment in 4 comprehensive real-time surveillance systems. Monitor pathogens in the environment, such as wastewater and air, and in animals, such as deer, rats, and others. Track emerging variants. Assess population immunity against respiratory viruses. Track hospitalizations, ICU admissions, and fatalities. Long COVID. The U.S. should have a national research program on long COVID that includes health, vaccination, and sociodemographic data. Researchers must get a better hold on the frequency of long COVID, whether asymptomatic or mild COVID is less likely to lead to long COVID, how well vaccines protect against long COVID, potential treatments for the condition, and immunological factors that predispose to or protect against long COVID. Definitely a long-term problem. The workforce. The authors of the report recognize that there are a record number of healthcare jobs unfilled and that burnout among healthcare workers is dangerously high. They noted that staffing shortages are the main limitation to the ability of the healthcare system to provide care. They proposed creating a pool of flexible healthcare workers to deploy in emergencies. And last but not least, which should be the center of the core public health functions, equity. The report acknowledged the pandemic's disproportionate impact on people of color, rural communities, and other underserved groups, and calls for solutions and strategies to prioritize health equity and the reduction of health disparities, with the end goal of building an equitable public health system capable of reaching underserved and historically neglected populations. Getting to this better place by creating some of the tools outlined in this report will require congressional and state legislation, as well as significant resources. Funding is especially critical, they added. Financing both the response to COVID and preparation for future biosecurity threats will be a wise investment with high returns to the nation. Okay, next up, some continuing coverage on Hong Kong, which is one of those supposedly zero COVID, and it ain't anymore. This from Bloomberg. Hong Kong's death rate is now world's highest. Hong Kong's COVID-19 death rate is now the highest in the world, after fatalities among the city's under-vaccinated elderly surged, and concerns mount there may be more to come as infections spread through care facilities. And next up, also from Bloomberg, China reports most daily COVID cases since Wuhan outbreak. China reported its biggest one-day tally of coronavirus infections since the Wuhan outbreak at the start of the pandemic, with efforts to contain its spread set to challenge the strict COVID-zero strategy that's isolated from the rest of the world. The nation announced 526 cases on Monday, including 312 asymptomatic infections, with multiple clusters around the country. Shanghai, which has seldom seen a flare-up during the pandemic, saw almost 50 infections. The port city of Qingdao had 163 centered around students at a high school, and the southern manufacturing hub of Dongguan reported 153 cases. Now, of course, the total absolute number of these cases is not what the story is. In fact, Northwest Ohio in the last week has had more cases than that, and China has a population of over a billion. So it's not so much what the number is, it's where that they're spread out, and that this is a potential break in the so-called firewall of their COVID zero strategy. With the new variants, it can be really hard to stop. I've been watching this for a while, and I must admit, it's going to be hard because at some point they're going to have to come out of this COVID zero strategy. Probably the biggest problem they have in doing that is that the Chinese-developed COVID vaccines have proven very ineffective at preventing Omicron infections. So really, if they're going to come out of COVID zero, they almost really need to come up with a better vaccine that can actually prevent some infection as well as prevent severity of disease, or they're going to have a rampage if it breaks through to a point where it's widespread and they really can't clamp down on it. And of course, like I reported before, this is a real issue because, like Hong Kong is being overrun now, if the China mainland gets overrun, besides that being a problem for the world's largest country, it's also a huge issue for supply chains and such, as China is integrated into the global economy, and there could be supply disruptions if it hits hard. Okay, well, let's come back locally and do the local COVID-19 update. This is getting much more short, and I would hope that in a matter of weeks or a month or two, we will not even be doing this every week, or it'll be really super brief. But we're down to 51 cases on average identified of COVID-19 in Lucas County. That's actually up from last week of 41, so it looks like we're kind of bouncing around at what might be kind of our, maybe our leveling out level, 40, 50 cases a day identified. But in really good news, the testing positivity rate in Lucas County was cut more than half, from 5.2 down to 2.5%. All right, Lucas County, it is getting there. and we're lower than Ohio and the U.S. by quite a bit, which is we've been more improved than both the state and the U.S. in recent weeks. So that's good news. Ohio's test positivity rate was 3.6%, and the U.S. as a whole was 3.3%. Both of those are in pretty good territory and are definitely heading the right direction. Okay, nursing homes. We've been running around the high 60s, low 70s for the last month. We had 67 active cases in Lucas County nursing homes in the most recent week reported. That's 34 residents and 33 staff. Unfortunately, we had a spate of deaths reported in the long-term care facilities. We had 6 new deaths. This is more deaths in 1 week of reporting than we have had in months and months. Actually, I don't mean in a week. I mean, this 6 deaths is more than we've had over a 2 or 3 month period recently. That's just some way. I don't know if that's a holdup in the death reporting, but it just goes to show that, I mean, long-term care facilities are vulnerable, and it looks like being hit by Omicron has pushed through and infected enough people, as we've seen by the numbers, and now we're starting to see the death numbers come through. The good news, I guess, in this case is that deaths are a lagging indicator. So while cases are way down, we're still seeing death rates actually fairly high in Lucas County and Ohio, and actually the U.S. as a whole, going down but still very high. Now, the University of Toledo, their case counts of what they identified or dropped in half down to 13, very low historically for what they've had, down from 26 the week before. So that's getting good. And they only identified 2 people through the hundreds and hundreds of people that they tested randomly. Only 0.3% of those people randomly tested positive. So that's looking good. Now, in the more severe cases in Lucas County, hospitalizations are still dropping steadily, and this is parallel with what's happening as a state as a whole. Nationally, deaths are as well dropping steadily to around 1,500 per day, and seems to be going down. Although this is still a large amount of death, COVID is still easily the number 3 leading cause of death in the U.S. today. Lucas County had 50 deaths in the last 2 weeks. This is a pretty high number given historically in the pandemic. So COVID is still killing people locally. You are listening to WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. This is Just for the Health of It, the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, one last COVID-related story. This is from CNN. Surgeon General launches effort to get to the bottom of COVID-19 misinformation. The Office of U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy issued a request for information surrounding health misinformation, seeking input and data from tech companies, healthcare providers, and community organizations. The request seeks to understand the scope and impact of misinformation on COVID-19, especially when it comes to healthcare and people's willingness to get vaccinated. Misinformation has had a profound impact on COVID-19 and our response, Murthy told CNN. Studies have demonstrated that the vast majority of the American public either believes common myths about COVID-19 or thinks those myths might be true, and many of those include myths around the COVID-19 vaccine. So we've seen firsthand how misinformation is harming people's health when it comes to COVID. This marks the first time the administration has called on tech companies to share certain data publicly, including data on the major sources of misinformation, how widespread it is, and who may have been targeted more than others. The focus has been on reaching out to tech companies with the broadest reach and use, Murthy said. And he wants them to be more transparent and open about sharing data with the public. We'll be looking forward to whatever information they have to share. We're certainly approaching this with an open mind, he said. Many of the new technology platforms have also been talking about solutions that they are trying to implement. But what we want to understand is what data do they have on whether these solutions are actually working or not. He said the information will also help public health researchers who, for too long, have not been able to successfully gather data about the impact of health misinformation found on the platforms. Health misinformation is making the jobs of healthcare workers much harder at a time when our healthcare workforce is strained, he said. I hear from healthcare workers that they are battling COVID in the hospitals during the day, and they're going home and battling health misinformation at night. Ultimately, the information will be shared with the public and used to steer responses to future public health emergencies. The American Medical Association applauded the Surgeon General's effort to root out COVID-19 misinformation online. And on that note, the following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. Okay, well, I'd like to switch gears a bit here and do a series of stories on our healthcare system, which in America is not really healthy, nor very caring, nor much of a system. Let's start up with Medical Express. There's an uptick in pricing by anesthesiologists. What role do management companies play? Prices paid to anesthesia practitioners increased after hospital outpatient departments and ambulatory surgery centers contracted with a physician management company and were substantially higher if the physician management company received private equity investment, according to a study by researchers at Columbia University School of Public Health and Cornell Medical College. Until now, little was known about the influence of a physician management company on prices. The findings are published in JAMA Internal Medicine. Physician management companies, many of which are backed by private equity firms, have grown increasingly common in anesthesia. These companies manage the back-end administration of medical practices, including insurance contracting and billing, and also provide staffing and management services to healthcare facilities. The aim of our research was to study changes in prices paid to anesthesiologists and certified registered nurse anesthetists after facility contracted with a physician management company, said Ambar LaForgia, assistant professor of health policy and management at Columbia School of Public Health. The paper considers the implications of corporate ownership in anesthesia for patients, practitioners, and payers, and helps to inform the current policy debate around the corporate practice of medicine. One way physician management companies may command higher prices is by amassing market share and by developing better negotiation expertise, noted LaForgia. Private equity-backed physician management companies may also have had stronger incentives to create short-term returns for investors relative to those without private equity investments. Physician management companies may also gain negotiating leverage over insurers by threatening to move practitioners out of network. Although we did not find evidence that practitioners moved out of network except for a modest increase in the year the contract started, the mere threat may be sufficient to influence negotiating dynamics between physician management companies and insurance companies. For-profit entities squeaking out more of a profit? Not surprising. Okay, next up, a little mini-series of three articles from Axios. First up, workers have to pay more upfront for care. As employers struggle to tame healthcare's market power, they have used the tools of less generous coverage, higher deductibles, co-pays, and co-insurance to offset some of the rising premiums. Why does this matter? Workers are increasingly finding their health insurance doesn't feel like insurance. By the numbers, the average single worker's deductible has tripled since 2006, and 30% of all companies now have annual deductibles of $2,000 or more, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation. The average deductible for individual workers was almost $1,700 in 2021. More than half of working families in high deductible plans had deductibles of at least $5,000. Federal law now outlaws most types of surprise bills, but workers could still face huge and unexpected costs depending on their network of hospitals and doctors. It's worth noting, employees who face the highest out-of-pocket medical costs are those who work in industries that often don't offer insurance, like food service, retail, and hospitality. Those industries disproportionately employ Black and Hispanic workers, and those workers are most vulnerable to being exposed to COVID-19, for example. And number two from Axios, the problem with getting health coverage through our jobs. The big honking problem is the prices that are being paid in the commercial sector, said Mark Miller, the former head of the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission. The big picture, annual per-person spending growth for workplace health insurance has exceeded the spending growth among Medicare and Medicaid patients in 9 of the past 13 years, according to federal data. That rise is almost entirely due to higher prices because enrollment and demand for services among the commercially insured have barely budged or fallen. Zooming in, federal regulations require hospitals to publish the prices they charge employer plans, exposing how companies pay different and significantly higher amounts for care. One example, major hip and knee replacement surgery at New York Presbyterian Hospital in New York City last year. Empire Blue Cross Blue Shield paid $98,000, Cigna paid almost $71,000, United Healthcare paid $66,000, Medicare paid around $20,000. Medicare plays closer to internationally reasonable rates, said Ted Doolittle, a former deputy director within the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Reading between the lines, healthcare providers contend the rates set by Medicare and Medicaid are too low, and they need to charge employers more to make up for that deficit. But that argument is undercut by research showing hospitals and doctors charge prices based on their market power instead of what other insurance programs pay. And third in the Axios miniseries, employers are flying blind when buying health coverage. Even after decades of being healthcare purchasers, companies ranging from small shops to Fortune 500 companies may not fully understand the health coverage they're buying and often pay more as a result. The big picture. Employers have been forced to look around and assemble this hodgepodge of vendors, says Francois de Brantes, a senior vice president at Signify Health. The vast majority don't have sophisticated benefit teams. What they're saying, employers trust the insurers, consultants, vendors, and other companies that cobble together their health and drug benefits, but many contractual terms that fly under the radar leave employers vulnerable to higher costs. One example? A health benefits consultant told Axios they recently audited a $1.8 million hospital bill for a company's employee and found $450,000 in overcharges. The employer was self-insured, so the employer's insurer didn't intervene because it wasn't on the hook for the costs. Many businesses start to wonder how bad their prescription drug deals were after Anthem, one of the largest health insurance companies in the country, alleged in 2016 that it got fleeced by its pharmacy benefit manager, Express Scripts. But employees haven't been willing to ditch things like drug rebates or drug copay cards, even though they can wind up increasing what employers pay. We understand that rebates, it's a shell game, Dwight Davis, a drug benefits consultant for Gemini Health, said during an interview. We're going to play the game as long as it's being offered. We don't want to shut it off. Folks, when it comes to your health and healthcare, hopefully it wouldn't have to be just a game. And while employees and workers get hit, healthcare workers take a triple hit. This from Medical Express. Healthcare wage growth has lagged behind other industries despite pandemic burden. A new analysis from Indiana University, the nonprofit RAND Corporation, and the University of Michigan highlights the changes in the U.S. healthcare workforce during the COVID-19 pandemic and found that the average wages for U.S. healthcare workers rose less than wages in other industries during 2020 and the first 6 months of 2021. This is in spite of the healthcare workforce shouldering a heavy burden of fighting the COVID-19 pandemic. Additionally, the wages in the healthcare sector increased at a lower rate relative to the national average across all sectors. Compared to 2019, there was a 5% increase in healthcare wages versus 6.7% for the national average in 2020, and a 1.5% increase in healthcare versus 6.9% nationally in 2021. I have a feeling that the public, patients, and healthcare workers would do much better in a national healthcare program, Healthcare for All. A system that's really a system.
It started in Norway in 1912. and they won't stop until everybody has healthcare. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get healthcare whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without healthcare. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
And if you were wondering whether government-delivered healthcare is better than privately-delivered healthcare, here's a story that gets to that from Medical Express. Veterans transported to VA hospitals had better survival rates than veterans taken to non-VA hospitals. The Veterans Health Administration, operated by the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, is the largest healthcare system in the United States, with 171 hospitals and more than 1,000 clinics that provide care for more than 9 million military veterans and their families. Since its establishment in 1930, there has been debate over quality and accessibility of care. A new study found that veterans transported by ambulance to VA hospitals had better 30-day survival rates than veterans transported to non-VA hospitals. The survival advantage was greater for Black and Hispanic patients and for patients with a history of receiving care at the hospital to which they were taken. The adjusted mortality rate at 30 days was 20% lower among patients taken to VA hospitals than among patients taken to non-VA hospitals. The mortality advantage was consistent across men and women, patient age groups, and different types of pre-existing conditions, but the advantage was particularly pronounced among Black patients and Hispanic patients. Widely publicized concerns about quality and capacity of the VA systems have fueled public perceptions that the VA health system falls short of providing appropriate care to the many veterans who depend upon it, said David Card, professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley, who co-authored the study. Our findings suggest that for the system overall, those perceptions do not match reality. This conclusion has important implications for health policy, Card continues. Enabling or encouraging veterans to obtain care outside the VA system could lead to worse, not better, health outcomes, particularly for veterans with established care relationships at VA facilities. This is a really good example. Finally, some research catching up to the public policy debates. You know, in recent years, when the VA capacity was limited, The arguments were, of course, send people to the private sector, and that, of course, is the kind of free market approach rather than expanding the already relatively expansive VA health system. Well, this seems to suggest that that actually having that system being robust and available is better than parsing it out to private market-based healthcare. Well, and for those of us who may be afraid that big isn't better, this from Stat News. This is how the private sector works, where big isn't always good. Justice Department sues United Health over nearly $8 billion deal to acquire tech company. Federal regulators are suing to block United Health Group's purchase of a technology company, Change Healthcare, a deal announced more than a year ago. The U.S. Department of Justice said that the proposed deal would hurt competition in markets for health insurance and technology used by insurers to process claims and cut costs. So, while people are concerned about big government, big private sector, when they can control the market, actually leads to higher costs and not necessarily even better service. Okay, well, next up's a good story to push back on another better way to do things. This is from CNN. nonprofit drug maker will provide insulin for no more than $30 a vial. Civica Rx, a nonprofit generic drug maker backed by hospitals, insurers, and philanthropies, announced that it plans to manufacture and sell insulin for no more than $30 a vial. It is expected to be available as soon as early 2024, pending federal approval. Insulin, which more than 8 million Americans with diabetes depend on, has been a poster child for the soaring cost of prescription drugs. Though insulin was discovered more than a century ago and cost little to make, the list price of the brand name products that Civica Rx is targeting it is roughly $300 per vial, according to the Gary and Mary West Foundation, which co-founded Civica Rx. The cost has nearly tripled since 2010. The high cost has led an estimated 1 in every 4 people with diabetes to ration or skip doses, according to a study published in 2019 in the medical journal JAMA, Internal Medicine. Patients who are Black, Latino, or Native American are disproportionately affected, since they are more likely to be uninsured or underinsured. Those who are going to benefit greatly from this opportunity that we are providing at Civica are those who are underinsured or uninsured, who cannot afford to pay for their drugs. Unlike other efforts, which focus mainly on lowering what the patients pay for insulin, Civica Rx aims to reduce the price of the medication itself. Civica's goal to produce and sell insulin at very low prices could be an important disruption to the current system, said Stacy Dutsima, associate professor of health policy at the Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. There are a couple of big potential wins for consumers. Okay, well, insulin's a good example of a larger problem, which is laid out by here by the Chicago Tribune. Medication insecurity is the next public health crisis. Nearly 2 billion people worldwide lack consistent access to the medicines they need to treat diabetes, asthma, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and other life-threatening illnesses. They are medicine insecure, meaning they don't have reliable, equitable access to the medicine and supplies they need. Here in the U.S., about 58 million people, nearly 1 in 4 adults, cannot afford to fill their prescriptions, according to a 2019 West Health Gallup survey. Some skip doses, cut pills in half, or use over-the-counter medications as substitutes. Others simply leave their scripts unfilled. A 2021 Kaiser Family Foundation survey found the problem is most pronounced for families earning less than $40,000 a year and those taking 4 or more prescriptions. If that was not alarming and upsetting enough, the problem's even more acute in communities of color. Among non-white Americans, medication insecurity jumped 10 percentage points from 21% to 31% from 2019 to 2010. And that's actually a 50% increase if you look at it relatively from 21 to 31%. This was compared to only a 3% jump for white Americans, according to the 2020 Gallup study. Yep, there's a reason why the vulnerable are called vulnerable. Okay, well, most people are aware that the pharmaceutical industry is not one of the favorites among U.S., even though there's a lot of cynicism about a lot of institutions. But this is from the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy from the University of Minnesota. Patients, pharma execs express low trust in drug supply chains. A recent international survey reveals that 40% of patients who rely on prescription drugs suspect that supply chain disruptions will put them at risk for illness and death from ineffective, contaminated, counterfeit, expired, or improperly labeled or stored products. While consumers became more aware of global supply chain dependencies and weaknesses amid COVID-19, the report author said, these problems were already well-rooted in the drug industry. 90% of patients indicated they were able to verify that their medications were not counterfeit. Tampered with or stored at an improper temperature is somewhat or very important. 81% said that medication manufacturers should have to disclose how their medications are made, and 82% said they want to know how their drugs were transported and stored. 80% of patients said they want to be able to verify country of origin for drug ingredients and local standards for production of drugs. Also, 79% said they want to know whether the source of their medication is sustainable and that the drug user uses methods to protect the environment, animal welfare, and public health. Upwards of 75% of patients said they had experienced problems with buying or taking medication. 82% of those aged 26 to 41 and 61% of those aged 58 to 76, which sort of gets at the fact that older consumers are probably a little more savvy about medication use. While those in the younger age group are twice as likely as the older age group to change pharmacies as a result of problems, 70% of all patients said they had changed healthcare providers, pharmacies, or medications. Among the patients recounting bad experiences, 32% reported they had needed a drug that was out of stock, 29% said they received only part of their prescription owing to unavailability, 27% cited a lower price elsewhere, 22% said they didn't receive their medication when they needed it, and 21% reported a severe adverse effect. Most patients, 76%, said they were concerned about drug affordability. 73% cited shortages. 69% said they feared taking the wrong dose of medication owing to a labeling error. And 85% indicated that pharmacies, including mail order operations, need to monitor the drugs they dispense. Okay, well, next up is a rather interesting story on a little more unusual side effect of medications. This from MedPage Today. Salt in fizzy tablets linked to heart death risk. Sodium-containing acetaminophen was associated with an increased cardiovascular and mortality risk in older people, according to a report sounding the alarm on the potential dangers of fast-acting prescription and over-the-counter drugs alike. A large UK database of electronic health records revealed significant excess in one-year incidence of myocardial infarction, that's a heart attack, stroke, and heart failure associated with sodium-containing acetaminophen therapy used compared with standard formulations. There was a 59% relative increase in risk for those with hypertension and a 45% relative increase in risk for those without hypertension. All-cause mortality risk over 1 year was twofold elevated in the hypertension patients taking sodium-containing acetaminophen and 87% elevated in users without hypertension. Risk increased in step with more prescriptions and longer duration of use of these medications, according to the study authors. Similar risks were observed for the subgroups of patients also using sodium-containing ibuprofen or ranitidine. Sodium-containing drugs are an important source of sodium intake that could be easily overlooked, study authors wrote. Given that the pain relief of non-sodium-containing acetaminophen is similar to that of sodium-containing acetaminophen, our results suggest revisiting the safety profile of effervescent and soluble acetaminophen use, whereas traditional formulations in tablet, oral suspension, or capsule form do not contain sodium. Fizzy or soluble drug preparations rely on it for fast-acting disintegration. And the sodium can really add up. If a given fizzy acetaminophen tablet has 400 milligrams of sodium, a day's worth at full dose would add 3,000 milligrams of sodium per day, far above the daily recommended sodium intake for an adult. Whew. Large increments would also be anticipated for other types of effervescent medications. With a single 5-gram sachet of effervescent antacids containing 850 milligrams of sodium, fizzy vitamins 280 milligrams of sodium per tablet, and urinary alkalinizers some 644 milligrams of sodium per dose. Particularly concerning is the observation in some surveys that up to 94% of uses of fizzy medications are self-medication using over-the-counter preparations. There is an immediate need for protection of consumers against these risks. The most plausible and effective strategy is likely to be mandatory labeling of all medications containing significant quantities of sodium with a front-of-pack warning label. Yes, folks, what you don't know can hurt you. And if you do know it, you can pick another product. Okay, well, dovetailing on that last story about sodium intake, let's do a little bit different one here, since sodium obviously is more of a dietary concern, but if your medications provide a huge amount, that's a concern as well. This from Science Daily. More spice can help seniors avoid salt. Add a little spicy seasoning to a low-sodium meal, and adults over the age of 60 may have a harder time noticing a lack of salt, according to a new study in the journal Food Quality and Preference. Led by Carolyn Ross, a professor of food science at Washington State University, the study tested saltiness perception in older adults using white sauce formulations with varying amounts of salt and different spices and seasonings added. The results of the analysis showed the addition of chipotle seasoning to the white sauce made it difficult for the study participants to differentiate between the samples with low and high levels of salt. Conversely, the addition of herbs such as basil leaves, garlic powder, and coarse ground pepper was not as effective as masking the samples with less salt. The research points to the significant role that spice could play in reducing salt intake for people over 60. We were working specifically with the population of older adults to see if we could reduce the amount of salt in a product and then tailor it to their tastes. This is important because the ability to taste and smell is known to weaken with age, and weaker perception of salty flavors may induce people to season their food with excessive salt, which may increase their risk of cardiovascular disease. I'm a big fan of this and personally like to add red pepper to just about everything. Gives a little tang and can even be confused for salty, which I guess is a good thing as far as your health, not to mention tasty. And in more diet news, this is from Medical Express. One in 10 Americans say they don't eat meat, a growing share of the population. About 10% of Americans over the age of 18 consider themselves vegan or vegetarian as of January 2022. This group of people, numbering some 16.5 million people, is evenly split between vegetarians and vegans. To be sure, the average American still consumes a lot of meat and poultry, more than 250 pounds per person every year, plus another 20 pounds of fish and shellfish. And of course, one of the big changes, since this is a huge increase from earlier studies even a few years ago, is the environmental concerns that people are starting to apply to their dietary choices, where using plant-based foods is much better for the environment. Okay, and another basic nutrition story, this from Medical Express. Calorie restriction trial reveals key factors in extending human health. Decades of research has shown that limits on calorie intake by flies, worms, and mice can enhance lifespan in laboratory conditions. But whether such calorie restrictions can do the same for humans remains unclear. Now, a new study led by Yale researchers confirms the health benefits of moderate calorie restriction in humans and identifies a key protein that could be harnessed to extend health in humans. The research was based on results from the comprehensive assessment of long-term effects of reducing intake of energy, which is a long name for the acronym CALORIE. So the CALORIE clinical trial, the first controlled study of calorie restriction in healthy humans. For the trial, researchers first established baseline calorie intake among more than 200 study participants. The researchers then asked a share of those participants to reduce their calorie intake by 14% while the rest continued to eat as usual and analyze the long-term health effects of calorie restriction over the next 2 years. There's so much debate about which type of diet is better, low carbohydrates or fat, increased protein, intermittent fasting, etc. But I think time will tell which of these are, important. But CALORIE is a very well-controlled study that shows a simple reduction in calories with no specific diet has a remarkable effect in terms of biology and shifting the immunometabolic state in a direction that's protective for human health. So, from a public health standpoint, I think it gives hope. Well, this type of result has been evident from a lot of other studies where people, for instance, like if you look at diabetes, which happens is much more frequent in people that are overweight or obese. So if folks with diabetes, particularly type 2 diabetes, actually go on a weight loss diet, even if they don't lose much weight, the fact that they're restricting their calories is really good at controlling their diabetes. So a lot of this is just being generalized in this study more to the general population rather than looking at particular diet studies in people that are in a disordered disease state. So our metabolism actually functions more efficiently and more healthily when it has a slight deficit of calories rather than an excess. Kind of get sloppy, playing it loose and free when you have excess calories. That seems to be an evolutionary thing that may not work out well in a world where there's way more calories than we need, but it gives a lot of insights. And this is good to have this well-controlled study to tell us that even just slight calorie restriction can be very beneficial for our health. So eat just a little bit less. Okay, well, next up, a seasonal story. Biological clock shock? Springing forward may have drawbacks for heart health. The Monday following the spring time change, that is after losing an hour of sleep, was associated with a 24% increase in daily heart attack counts, and the Tuesday following the fall time change, gaining an hour of sleep, was conversely associated with a 21% reduction in heart attacks, according to a study from Michigan. So there you go. Sleep. Good, basic pillar of health. A foundation of health. Get enough sleep. And we see it work both directions. This is a grand natural experiment changing the time as far as studying sleep in the entire population. When you get an hour less, you get 24% more heart attacks. When you get an hour more, you get 21% less. Okay, well, next up, big study here on cannabis. This is from Medical Express. Cannabis use produces persistent cognitive impairments. A systematic review published in the scientific journal Addiction has found that cannabis use leads to acute cognitive impairments that may continue beyond the period of intoxication. This Canadian-led meta-review, a review of reviews, merged the findings of 10 meta-analyses representing more than 43,000 participants. The study found that cannabis intoxication leads to small to moderate cognitive impairments in areas including making decisions, suppressing inappropriate responses, learning through reading and listening, the ability to remember what one reads or hears, and the time needed to complete a mental task. These and other acute impairments mirror the residual effects documented for cannabis use, suggesting that the damaging effects of cannabis begin while it is being consumed and persist beyond that period. Our study enabled us to highlight several areas of cognition impaired by cannabis use, including problems concentrating and difficulties remembering and learning, which may have considerable impact on users' daily lives, said the study co-author Dr. Alexandre Dumas, Associate Clinical Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Montreal. Cannabis use in youth may consequently lead to reduced educational attainment, and in adults, to poor work performance and dangerous driving. These consequences may be worse in regular and heavy users. Cannabis is the third most consumed psychoactive substance in the world, after alcohol and nicotine. And adolescents as well as young adults have the highest rates of cannabis use. Recent global changes in the legalization of cannabis suggest that public perceptions of its safety and acceptability are on the rise. It is therefore important to understand the cognitive risks involved in using cannabis, especially to young people whose brains are undergoing significant developmental changes. Okay, well, next up, step up to some little harder drugs. This from NPR. Black Americans are now dying from drug overdoses at a higher rate than whites. When the first phase of the opioid epidemic was cresting in 2010, driven largely by prescription pain medications, white Americans were dying of fatal drug overdoses at rates twice that of black Americans. In the decade that followed, drug deaths surged again. But this time, black communities faced the brunt of the carnage. Overdose rates have been growing fastest among black communities, says Joseph Friedman, an addiction researcher at UCLA. For the first time, we see them overtaking the overdose rate among white individuals. It's a devastating milestone, documented in a peer-reviewed study published in the journal JAMA Psychiatry. The research is based on drug deaths from 1999 through 2020, the most recent comprehensive overdose data available. Preliminary data from the CDC suggests the situation has grown even worse over the past year as fatal overdoses topped 100,000 for the first time in 2021. Friedman says the biggest factor leading to dramatically higher overdose deaths among black people with substance use disorders is pretty simple. The illicit drug supply. The street drug supply is becoming more and more toxic, he says. That's because of fentanyl, the potent synthetic opioid, which Mexican drug cartels are now mixing into many of the street drugs sold in the U.S. Fentanyl has made drug use far deadlier for all Americans across all demographics. But this new study suggests African Americans are more vulnerable because they often rely on illicit drug supplies that are even more high risk. People who are lower down on the social hierarchy tend to be exposed to fentanyl and other highly potent synthetic opioids at disproportionate rates, said Dr. Helena Hansen, a co-author of the report. As a consequence, you find black Americans are exposed to fentanyl more often than white Americans, she says. Hansen, who is black, is also a researcher at UCLA. She says African Americans with substance use disorder also frequently lack access to healthcare and drug treatment. They're arrested and incarcerated at much higher rates. This means they tend to have fewer chances to get healthy and to avoid relapses that expose drug users to fentanyl. We have in this country two tiers, a criminalized tier which still over-polices and over-arrests and over-incarcerates black and brown Americans, Hansen says. And then we have a medicalized tier that's more available in white communities. This research follows a study published last month in the medical journal Lancet that forecasts more than 1.2 million additional drug overdose deaths in the U.S. in the coming decade. A larger percentage of this next million deaths will be black and other people of color. Researchers say the way to prevent many of those deaths in the black community is well documented in scientific and medical literature. Provide better health care and more access to addiction treatment. Okay, next up from Medical Express. 4.6 million children living in home with loaded, unlocked firearms in U.S. Roughly 4.6 million U.S. children live in a household with loaded and unlocked firearms, according to a research letter published in JAMA Network Open. The researchers found that 40% of adults with children lived in a household with firearms, meaning 30 million children lived in households with firearms. That's 7 million more than in 2015. Just over one-third of firearm owners lived with children, 36%, had unlocked firearms, and 37% had loaded firearms. 15% of gun owners with children reported storing at least one firearm loaded and unlocked, which is the least safe, while 44% reporting storing all firearms unloaded and locked. The trend towards safer storage we observed in 2021 was offset by the increase in the proportion of adults with children who live in households with firearms, the authors write. So, as a percent of people who own firearms, More are doing safe storage, but the rapid increase in number of firearm owners, particularly in households with children, is increasing. So we're still seeing a huge number, almost 5 million children in the U.S. living in a home with loaded and unlocked firearms. Dangerous. Okay, well, I want to close the reporting this week with something a little bit more good news. We're going to go international for this, from Medical Express. Analysis of a 20-year study finds malaria control in young children saves lives into adulthood. Bed nets save lives in the long run, according to a 22-year study in Tanzania, which, for the first time, indicates that children who sleep under them at an early age are more likely to survive into adulthood. The study, published in the New England Journal of Medicine, followed more than 6,700 children from 1998, tracking them again in 2019 to find out what happened to them. The results showed that survival of children who habitually slept under nets was over 40% higher compared with survival of those who slept under nets less frequently in their early childhood. Malaria killed more than 600,000 people in 2020 and is especially dangerous for children. The disease, which is common in sub-Saharan Africa, is caused by a parasite transmitted through mosquito bites. In malaria-endemic areas, sleeping under a bed net treated with insecticide is one of the most effective ways to protect young lives. Until now, however, the long-term effect of malaria control in early childhood has been unclear. Theory suggests that preventing malaria in early life could make people more vulnerable later in life due to a lack of immunity, simply delaying life-threatening illness and death. Estimates from this rare long-term observational analysis appear to counter this theory by finding no evidence that prevention in early life leads to a surge in deaths later on. And how terrible would that be to survive longer only to die later? It's good that it doesn't result in some kind of bounce back. But yes, prevention, even for a period of time, is good. I mean, we're all going to die at some point, of course. Okay, well, let's get to this week's bonus articles, which you can read online, just like all the other stories I've reported on. I'll give you the link at the end. 17 stories today. First up, what to tell kids about Ukraine. Recommendations from a psychologist talking about difficult issues. Ukraine and war could be one of those. Two, Ukraine conflict could spark surges of COVID, polio, and other diseases. War is not good for you. Three, Russia's war on world's breadbasket threatens food supply. That region of the world produces a lot of grains particularly. And obviously moving that food supply is a problem too when you're in the middle of a war. And two stories here on how racial ethnic gaps actually have increased recently in COVID. Four, alarming disparities leave parts of LA County hard hit by COVID-19. And five, COVID hospitalizations in New York City saw biggest racial gap during Omicron. And if you're wondering if that's isolated to just big cities in the U.S., wrong. Six, the pandemic is following a very predictable and depressing pattern. As with diseases such as malaria and HIV, rich countries are, quote, moving on from COVID, while poor ones continue to get ravaged. Seven, high demand for drug to treat COVID in the vulnerable, yet doses go unused. This is antibody treatment used preventively for people like with immune suppression who the vaccines don't work in. So we have a lot of these doses and they're not getting to the people who need them. Another problem with our fragmented healthcare system. Eight, turning to social media to get affordable insulin, a clear sign of a broken healthcare system. Nine, the Biden administration killed America's collective pandemic approach. Protections meant to shield everyone can't be a matter of just personal preference. 10. Here's what experts say Biden gets right in his new mental health plan. 11. More black Americans are buying guns. Is it driving up black suicide rates? The short answer is yes. 12. Debunking the, quote, excited delirium diagnosis for deaths in police custody. Report breaks down how the term was created and misused for years. 13. Synthetic opioids stronger than fentanyl have cropped up in the U.S. 14. Wood-burning stoves raise new health concerns. Officials increasingly treat wood smoke pollution as a public health and environmental justice issue. And that is a smaller issue of this. 15. Particulate matter pollution, destabilizing Earth's climate and a threat to health. 16. The limits of, quote, following the science, as societal values are subjective and need to be factored in. And last but not least, I reported on happiness. This is the Yale's happiness professor says anxiety is destroying her students. She also gives some solutions to that. You can read these stories at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's TOPPUN.com, blog, WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-